On the gridiron, he coached Fresno City College to 4 state championships in a span of just 6 seasons. But a quarter century earlier, he was fighting the Japanese as a United States Marine.
You had no idea what it was like until you did it. I mean, the idea of people, you just, no matter what you did in practice, you can't practice being aimed at.
Hear Coach Claire Slaughter remember World War II on Hometown Heroes today at 1 on News Talk 580 or 5 p.m. on FM 105.9 KMJ.
News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday on KMJ, whether you listen to us on the AM 580 at 1 o'clock, FM 105.9 at 5 o'clock, or online anytime at kmjnow.com. You know that each week we visit with World War II veterans. It's because we want to honor their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories. And along the way, be inspired as we learn about our greatest generation. We're going to talk to a Marine Corps veteran of World War II today, who, if you've been around Fresno for any length of time, is probably a name that you know because of his great success on the gridiron as a player and a coach. 91-year-old Claire Slaughter of Fresno, California, our guest today. Growing up, though, you were not in Fresno County. You were down in Tulare County in Porterville. What was life like as a high school sports star there for the Porterville Panthers?
Well, no. Don't know about being a star thing or not, but if you were a young kid in Porterville, well, you looked forward to going to Porterville High School and playing all sports, not just football, but that was the big one.
What was your favorite sport? Because I've read that you were pretty much all everything in every sport you played.
Well, we just did play all sports. Probably my best sport was basketball, but I liked football the best.
Were you generally one of the bigger guys on the field when you played?
I was tall and skinny. No, the most I ever weighed was 180, which wasn't the biggest by any means, but that was good size.
And after high school, you played at Porterville Junior College, and then you got a chance to go play for a legendary head coach up in Stockton. Do you remember when Amos Alonzo Stagg said he wanted you to play for the COP Tigers back then?
Well, I was just trying to think about why I went to Pacific. Mr. Stagg was one of the reasons, that's for sure. I had some friends that were going to go to Pacific, and I had some other friends that were already there, and it was just a good place for me to go, and which I did, and I had a great, great time of it, and glad I went there.
And so you were there playing for Amos Alonzo Stagg for Pacific. You played against schools like Fresno State and San Jose State. Was there a highlight for you of being a college football player? Do you have a favorite memory from your playing days?
Oh, my gosh. That's probably the biggest thing of all was just our games. Always looking forward to playing San Jose and Fresno State. But I can't think of any one game that was special. They were all special.
Did you have aspirations of getting paid to play somewhere and being a professional? Did you have those thoughts in your mind?
Oh, I wasn't that good. No. Never really thought about playing. I wasn't big enough, really. Like I said, I was tall and skinny. I was built for basketball, not football, but my favorite sport was football. No question about that.
You played basketball in Stockton at Pacific too, didn't you?
Well, I played all sports up there. Mm-hmm. That's what I'd done all my life. I went football and then basketball and spring track. I was a high jumper. Enjoyed them all.
Well, and it sounds like you were a perfect candidate for the Marine Corps because of your athleticism, but I know you weren't thinking about that yet. Your 21st birthday, December 8th, 1941, something happened the day before that kind of changed the world, but something happened the day before that. I guess you guys had a football game in San Diego that weekend?
Played San Diego State on we were supposed to play Friday night, but it rained us out. It rained so much they just postponed the game, and we played Saturday afternoon, and so that was the last game of the season. So after the game was over, Mr. Stagg gave us permission, my wife now. Her brother was the tailback on the team, and I was a receiver. So we hitchhiked back from San Diego. We're on the road and didn't know about Pearl Harbor until we got into Bakersfield at noon on the 8th.
So when you heard that news that Pearl Harbor had been attacked, what did it mean anything to you at the time?
Not really. I mean, the importance of it, well, we're at war, so what? I mean, no, it didn't, but it soon did. Very definitely.
Well, and I want to get to that, but you alluded to the fact that your wife's brother was on the team with you. Of course, she wasn't your wife then, but you had met her By then, tell me about when you met Ev.
Oh, gosh, Ev's a twin. And John was the tailback on the single wing that Mr. Stagg used, and he was the thrower, and I was a receiver. So I'd be going, now I got to be close friends with him, and through him met her, and looks what happened.
And you said Pearl Harbor didn't mean a lot to you then, but it would later. How was that that you ended up one of the few, the proud, the Marines?
Well, there was just no question about it that we were going to join the Marines. Because we wanted to be in the best, and that's stupidly we joined the Marines.
And who's we?
The tailback on our John, my friend. But he got he came down with a very serious illness and died very soon after that. We lost him in the first part of the war.
And after being a college football player and playing for a guy like Stagg, who was so demanding of his players and so tough and by the book, was the Marine Corps a big adjustment for you, or do you think you were already prepared for some of that?
Well, I don't think you can ever be prepared for the Marines until you actually belong. No, football was just part of my life, always. That's all of my life from the time I was a little kid that what I wanted to be was a football player.
They said nothing can ever prepare you for the Marines. When you got into the Marine Corps, how did they welcome you? How did they whip you into shape? Did you have some of those old breed World War I Marines bossing you around?
Yes, very definitely. They were they were just tough. When they said jump, you just ask how high, and that was it. And you learned to do real fast what you were told to do, the Marine Corps way, and there was a very definite way the Marines did things. And I was full speed ahead, yeah.
And you had met this pretty lady. I imagine you wanted to keep in touch with her while you were over there serving for Uncle Sam. Did you write letters back and forth?
Oh, yeah, but there was nothing in the way of love or anything between us up until after I got out of the service and got back. But, yeah, she wrote occasionally. I didn't write many letters to anybody except my folks much, but wrote her a few letters, not many.
What was the first moment for you in the Marine Corps where you felt, this is real, this could cost me my life, this is dangerous stuff I'm up against? Do you remember a moment where that kind of really hit you in the face?
Not really until after we had landed on the first amphibious landing and they started shooting at you. Then you realized it was something pretty serious. But yeah, until that time, you had no idea what war was about.
Well, I'm going to ask you about that. You mentioned how you found out about Pearl Harbor, but I guess we skipped the detail. I guess you already had a pilot's license at this point?
Yes.
When did you start flying?
It was in Porterville. I started to fly when I was still in high school.
So after Pearl Harbor, I guess you tried to use that pilot's license and get into the Army Air Corps right away? Why'd they say no?
Couldn't pass physical.
What was wrong with you?
Eyesight.
Was that upsetting to you?
Oh, yes, very definitely. I knew that my eyes were bad, but I wanted to get into that branch of the service. It was upsetting.
I understand you wanted to get in so bad that even after the American Air Corps turned you down, you tried to head north and get the Canadians to take you. Is that true?
Yeah.
What'd you do?
Well, I just went up to Canada and tried to join. They wouldn't. They said, no, you go back to the United States. They wouldn't take me.
So then you had to say, okay, it's the Marines for me. And you went with your buddy John and signed up right then.
That's when we went together.
What kind of image did you have in your mind, do you think, of what it meant to be a Marine? What did that mean to you, that you were a Marine?
They tried to install in people who came into the Marines that feeling that, you know, you were, this was the best, and you felt that way, and you knew it was, compared to to being drafted into the Army. That was what the other guys did, not you. You'd do something better.
Well, and anyone who played for you at Fresno City College and saw your crew cut all those years saw the hallmark of the Marine Corps that was still with you throughout that time. Your first taste of action with the Marines, was that at Saipan?
My first taste of action was the landing at Saipan, yes.
So that was going on in June and July of 1944, so a long time ago.
June the 15th was the day we landed.
Was there some anticipation, do you think, before that? Were you anxious? Were you fearful? What do you remember about what was going through your mind before you hit those beaches?
You had no idea what it was like until you did it. I mean, the idea of people, you just, no matter what you did in practice, you can't practice being aimed at. Well, I remember the first time as we were going in, probably I was maybe 200 or 300 yards offshore, and water was about waist deep, and we were wading in. And the guy next, right next to me got hit and went down, and we grabbed him to keep him, he was dead. So that was the first real feeling, well, this is what war is. It was quite an understanding.
Yeah, and I'm sure they didn't stop shooting after they got him. The bullets were still flying, right?
Oh, yeah. That was they were still shooting at us.
And when you're in a situation like that, does it feel like it never ends? Does it feel like it lasts a lot longer than it really does? When could you finally kind of rest or breathe easy again?
I don't think you ever could. No, you never did really feel easy because you knew that another one was coming. And you didn't want another one to come because you knew what it was like going in on a landing, and it wasn't a very pleasant thing, because there's always that fear of death. But you didn't afraid that it was part of it, so you weren't really afraid of it. But you knew you might die, and you didn't like the idea, of course.
Well, and when they shoot the guy right next to you, right when you're hitting the water, that's not very encouraging. I've talked to a lot of veterans over the years, and some guys say they talk about the bond they had with the men that they served with. Every once in a while, I'll talk to someone else who said, you know, he was really afraid to get close to anybody because he didn't want to go through that heartbreak knowing some of them would die. How would you describe what your relationship was like with the Marines that you served with? Were you guys pretty close?
Oh, I think very close. You had to be because you were with them and you knew what you were doing, what you were going into. And you were close with the people. I was. We were. You knew you had some good people there with you, which helped.
So you were part of that initial landing on Saipan. That was the start of the battle on June 15th, right?
Yes, June 15th.
So from there, what kinds of things did you do? Were you trying to take certain positions? Give us a taste of what a day in the life of Captain Claire Slaughter was in 1944.
Well, I wasn't a captain then.
That took some time. What was your rank at the time?
Second lieutenant. I went through the service here in the station, became a second lieutenant in the Marine Corps when I joined. And I stayed that way for 2 or 3 years before I made up to Canada. I didn't move up very fast. What was it like? That's hard to answer.
From what I know of Saipan, and I've heard stories about that engagement from a lot of different perspectives, but you make that initial landing on June 15th, and that island wasn't declared secure for over a month. And I'm guessing there were some long days and nights there for you. Was it hard to sleep some nights? Did you ever feel secure in a situation like that?
Feel secure? Probably not. But as I think about it, I'm trying to think how I really felt. Well, you knew why you were there, and you knew what you had to do, and you just knew you it was going to be done, and you were going to do it. So you look forward to getting it done and get it over with.
And what kind of weapons did you have at your disposal? What did you carry on you?
Well, being an officer, the only weapon you had was a 45 caliber pistol. But all of us carried a carbine, the small, that's when the carbine came out. And so we all of us had one of those. You just had to have it.
But you never had to use it, did you?
Well, I shot a couple of times, yeah.
I said that tongue-in-cheek, of course. Give us a sense, for people who've never been to Saipan, or certainly weren't there when it was being fought over in 1944, what was that terrain like, and could you find cover? Did you ever know where the enemy was? Give us a taste of what that setting was like.
Okay, Mount Topacha was the high point of the island. It wasn't a big island. It was about, I think, probably 3 miles wide and maybe 10 miles long. And where we landed was a good beach. It was just a sandy beach for the whole half of the island over there. But it was an easy landing as far as landing, and we didn't have a lot of opposition on the landing, because even the strafing that they and the bombing that they put on those places was just amazing, just that anybody could be alive. But they were. But you just knew what you were going to do, and you had to do it.
But from the beach to taking Mount Topachow, as you guys did, I'm guessing that wasn't a cakewalk. There had to be some times in there where you weren't sure that was going to happen. What was the biggest obstacle to you guys doing that?
Well, there was never any question in your mind that you weren't going to do it. I mean, it had to be done. You know what you were going to do, and we knew we had the troops coming behind us to back us up. Any number of whatever it took would be there, so it was a done deal as far as we're concerned. We just had to do what we had to do, and if we're lucky enough not to get hit in any way, we could come out alive.
And what was it that you had to do? How did you make that advance to that high point?
He just went. He just.
Is there a strategy or a mechanism to how you gain a little ground at a time? And you as an officer, I imagine you've got some guys who are depending on you for leadership in that situation. So how did you lead them to that point?
Well, you knew where you were going, and you'd studied the pictures, movies they'd taken of the land, and so you knew what was there, and you could figure out where the enemy was for the most part. And so as you landed and started moving in ashore, then you'd lead your troops. Well, I had a platoon, but there was troops the whole length of the island landing. Then you'd pick your little spot where you'd think, now there's a good spot to go, and you'd head for there.
As much as you were prepared by seeing the topography and all that, it seems to me that in some ways it's a lot like a football game, that you've got to improvise quite a bit along the way. Did you ever find yourself doing something and then stopping and saying, wow, how did I just do that?
Why did I just do that? Quite often you wonder, you get to a spot where you wonder, should I be here? Why am I here? Yeah, you felt that way. I did.
What got you through those moments, do you think, when you ask yourself that question? Is there an answer that eventually comes to you? Or how do you move on?
Well, you just know you got to do it. You have no choice. The Marines say you're going to go.
The fact that you had other men under you that were depending on you, is that something that was a burden of responsibility on you, or do you think that was a motivator for you? How did that play out in your experience?
Well, I'd say both. It was certainly a motivator, but because you knew that you wanted to do what was right for yourself to begin with, because you had to lead them. So knowing that way, you just knew you had to do the right thing. So you're always looking for the best way to move, where to go, and what you should do, yeah.
Well, what we need to do right now is take our first commercial break. But when we come back, more from 91-year-old Claire Slaughter. Long before becoming a Hall of Fame football coach, he was a Marine in the Pacific in World War II. More of his story, plus we'll hear from another voice you might recognize before we're done with Hometown Heroes today on KMJ. Well, that countdown is at 49. 49 days until Fresno State kicks off the 2012 football season against Weber State. But we're just 5 days away from your chance to spend an evening with a guy who will probably be talking in your living room every Saturday this fall. Say what? Paul Leffler here, and I'm talking about Dave Pasch, one of ESPN's top college football announcers on television and the voice of the NFL's Arizona Cardinals on the radio. Dave and his wife Hallie will be in Fresno this Thursday, July 19th, and they have quite a story, from big games and big names to Hallie's life-altering battle with a brain tumor. Come hear it all at Pardini's in Fresno this Thursday evening at 6, presented by CBMC Fresno. Call 559-225-5095. That's 225-5095, or go to cbmcfresno.com. We'll talk football, family, and faith. And the buffet dinner is just $10 at Pardini's this Thursday. That number again, 559-225-5095.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Visiting today with 91-year-old Claire Slaughter of Fresno. He won 136 games and 4 state championships in 20 years as the football coach at Fresno City College. But that never would have happened if he hadn't survived intense combat on the island of Saipan 68 years ago. We heard him describe wading ashore and having the Marine next to him gunned down. By mid-afternoon of that first day of the invasion, the Marines had suffered more than 2,000 casualties. Thankfully, Claire Slaughter wasn't one of them. We heard him mention the high ground of Mount Tapachow, a pivotal point on the island. I've heard stories about some of the caves on Saipan, strongholds for the Japanese. Did you encounter any of those caves on your way up to Mount Tapachow?
Oh, yeah. Lots of caves. And that was always a problem, because you had to clean the caves out before you could move on.
And I guess everything in war, there's that factor of the unknown. But to me, a cave seems to heighten that a little bit. If you don't know what's in there waiting for you, how do you proceed? What is the method to your madness in exploring a cave like that and making sure there aren't any Japanese in there?
Well, you knew there were Japanese in there, so you knew you had to get them out.
Flamethrowers or what?
Oh, yeah, flamethrowers, and just sending one or two or three guys in to start with, and just back them up with what it took to get in there. You just did it.
And I've also heard stories about some of these caves that perhaps if the Japanese had already abandoned, they might have booby-trapped them somehow. Did you ever come across any booby-trap situations over there?
Oh, yeah. They did that to nearly every, not all the time, but a good part of the time, that's true, they did. So you always were careful and looking for signs and which you could see, figure out they'd done something, yeah.
But none of them ever got you or came close to getting you?
Didn't get me, I'm here.
Amen. We're thankful for that. Did you have a sense? And this, again, this is the first battle that you've been involved in, and it doesn't get the press that Okinawa, a battle you were in, gets, or certainly Iwo Jima. But Saipan was important, the hop over to Tinian, and then they had all those runways for the B-29s. And at that point, this is the only battle you've ever known. So did it seem like it took forever? Did you experience a sense of relief when the battle wound down? How did that play out in your memory?
I find it hard to answer because, yes, I know it was a feeling of relief when it was over. That's for sure. But you knew what you had to do. You knew what was coming. And so you expected the worst and hoped for the best.
Do you remember celebrating at all with your buddies when the island was finally secure and you guys had accomplished your mission?
Oh, we never celebrated because you knew another one was coming, and it was just a matter of time before you went to another operation. And there wasn't any there was happiness, but there wasn't a lot of celebration, no.
Obviously, that's a pretty close call when you're heading to the beach and they take out the guy next to you. But was there anything else on Saipan that you remember as coming particularly close to you being one of the guys that didn't come home?
The one thing I remember was there were a lot of things that happened where there'd be a shell would land somewhere close to you and explode. And so that was not a unusual thing. But this one night, I'd gone back. My immediate superior had called me back. I had to go back and see. We had a meeting back there of the different officers in charge of the guys up front. So going back to where I was headed for, I just crawling on my stomach to get out there, and I was still quite a ways away when all of a sudden there was a couple of shots, and there was a Japanese right near me that had just gotten up out of a foxhole. I didn't know he was there, and somebody else saw him and shot him before he got a chance to get me. So that's the closest I really came to it right then.
And you never would have known. You had no idea he was there. So without that fellow Marine taking him out for you, you wouldn't be here talking to me.
Probably not.
Well, I'm glad you are, and I know our listeners are too. And I want to get back to the top of Mount Tapachow there on Saipan. I know you're humble. You don't want to brag about anything, but I understand you were pretty involved in capturing an enemy stronghold up there.
There was a room right up the top of the mountain, pretty good-sized room. We were probably maybe half as big as this room. And that was where the headquarters was for all of the enemy troops was there.
Right, so the whole Japanese opposition on Saipan is being controlled and commanded from this room that you went into. Did you know that's where you were headed? Did you know that was the objective, to knock out the head of the snake, as it were?
No, we didn't know that it was the head of it, no. We just knew there was an important place we were supposed to take, so that's what we did.
And how did you do that? This sounds a little scary to me, and it sounds like you kind of went in a little blindly.
You're always blind. You don't know who it is, what they got there, how many people. It's, you might have an idea, but you don't know what you're going to face. So that's why when we always had a lot more troops than they had. So it's just a matter of doing it, that's all. You had to do it. That's part of being a Marine. That's what you did, and you did it.
So this cave, this operational headquarters, there was one man ahead of you? You guys were the first two in there?
Yeah.
What did you see when you turned that corner, or maybe there's another way to describe it, but when you got to the entrance of that, what did you guys see? How did you know what was in there?
Well, we didn't know. We just went in, and we were lucky.
By taking that position and flushing them out of there, did that have a strategic importance?
Well, I'm sure it did have. That was just part of what we were doing. You went after the enemy. Wherever he was, you went after him. And we knew there was an enemy there, and we assumed he might be in there, so we assumed he was in there.
And I understand. I can tell that you don't want to get into any more of the details of that cave and how you captured it. I understand and respect not wanting to go back there and relive all of it. We can move on. You stayed on Saipan for months after that island was secure, all the way into the spring of 1945, when what would prove to be the last major land battle of the war was about to unfold.
We didn't leave Saipan until we left to go up to Okinawa. We made a fake landing on the whole south end of Okinawa was probably half a mile wide, quarter of a mile wide. And so we made a fake landing down there and went right almost ashore, just outside of the range of the small arms fire from the shore, and then turned around and went back. And because then they landed at the same time up around Naha, the capital, which was up, and they had no opposition at all landing. And so they went clear across the island, and a good friend of mine, Bill Briarski, was in that bunch. They were surprised. They went clear across and didn't see an enemy. Then they opened up on them.
So you guys were the decoy, almost like a play-action fake in one of your football games, huh?
Yeah, that's exactly what we were. fake. They made them think, we hoped we made them think that that's where we're coming in, and that they would bring their troops down there so where they did go in, and which is what happened. It worked out real well that they had no opposition at all, and of course we didn't go in. We turned around and went back. Yeah, it worked out good.
And then you guys circled back up to the top and landed at Naha?
Went back, came in at Naha, and then joined the fighting to go to the south end of the island.
And by that time, of course, the Japanese knew where all the Americans were, and the fighting was pretty fierce. The artillery shells were flying, and ground combat was happening. So I'm sure you eventually engaged the enemy there on Okinawa, huh?
Yeah, we went south first and then took that. Then we had very little opposition up north. So, yeah, that's exactly what happened.
Did it ever strike you the magnitude of what was happening there? I mean, when you hear those countless artillery shells going off and those big 105s and 155s firing away, did you ever feel like you were a part of something really huge?
Never thought about it. It was just all war. You had to do it, and so you did it.
You were too busy trying to survive, huh?
Absolutely. That's exactly what it was, too. Just do it. Just get it done. Get out of here.
What impact did it have on you when a guy from your platoon or somebody that was serving under you was wounded or killed? What did that do to you?
You knew it was going to happen. And so you expected it, so you couldn't let it bother you, because if you let it bother you, then you couldn't do your job. So I can't say you ignored it, but you practically just ignored it because you had to. You had to go ahead and do what you had to do.
And I'm sure that's part of what helped you survive and be here today. But for those of us who weren't there, who haven't experienced something like that, who maybe don't understand what it's really like to be out there preserving our freedom, can you give us a sense of how that existence was to be on that island, to be leading these guys, to not know where the next bullet is coming from, to not know if you're going to survive the day? What were those days like for you?
As I think back about it, I know I was afraid. Not probably just fear that I wouldn't do my job the way it should be done. Very definite. There's always anxiety. And you just knew that, you know, you had a job to do. You just, regardless of what the situation, do it. And so that's what you did.
Was it hard to catch any sleep in those situations?
Oh, no. You could sleep. One thing you knew, you didn't think about it, but you realized that if you were sleeping, that nothing's going to bother you. You're not aware of what's going on, so you could sleep it off, I guess.
How often did you think about coming home, about this war being over and you being back in America?
How many times in a day? Oh, you always thought about that. You just knew that that's why you did it, because you knew this had to be done. So do it and get it over with so you can go home.
And did you guys hear rumblings that the war was coming to an end? Were you still on Okinawa when they dropped the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki? How'd you hear about that?
Somebody told us that we had done that, and so we figured that it was getting closer.
And what did it mean to you when you heard the war is over, the Allies have won, Japan has surrendered, this war is over? What did that mean to you?
Oh, it just meant everything. Just thank God it's over. And I can't put that in any other words except just all this is over. I can go home now.
So when did you get home? What was that like?
We got into San Francisco. This other guy and I hitchhiked to Stockton, mm-hmm, from San Francisco. And we were both upset because nobody was there to meet us. But the people didn't have a way to go anywhere in those days. They didn't have a car. They couldn't, you couldn't get gas. So we hitchhiked home and got home.
And how long did it take before you ran into Ev again and realized she had grown up a little bit? You guys got married in August of 46, so you must not have wasted too much time.
As soon as we got back, of course, that's right where I went. I lived there before I'd gone into the service, because their folks were just like my folks. And so this is where I went back and stayed there with him, and she was there, and we got together.
Kind of seems like somebody was pulling some strings on that one for you.
Yeah, I didn't know that was going to happen, though, but it did.
And if you have anything else about, you know, your Marine Corps days that you want to share, I don't want to gloss over any of that. But to go from the Marine Corps to a football coach, how was that transition for you? And was that smooth? Was that difficult? Were there some challenges you faced? What do you remember about that?
From being a Marine to coaching football? Mm-hmm. Well, it was, once the war was over, I could never describe the feeling. I or we had, because all of a sudden it's over. And all everything we'd been doing, forget it. Mm-hmm. We had nothing to do with it anymore. And that just, once the war was over, then right then I just felt free. I knew that I was going to live, I was going to make it. I wouldn't have to go into this fight a war someplace. A great feeling of relief and a completely different outlook on life from there on in, because you had a future now, whereas before you didn't have a future.
Yeah, and I guess I should ask you, had you been under the assumption that you would have participated in invading Japan if it came to that?
Well, we knew. The 2nd Marine Division was the first part of the landing troops, and we knew a long time before then that we were going to be the landing force on Japan, and we weren't very happy about that, I'll tell you.
Well, why would you be? You'd already seen how the enemy fought to the death, and now this would be their homeland.
It would have been terrible, yeah.
So are you one then who feels that by Harry Truman saying, go ahead, drop those bombs, that by doing so he saved your life?
Oh, I'm sure it did, yeah. I can't say it saved my life, but it very possibly could have saved my life, because I mean, that ended the war, so I'm glad he dropped them.
I don't blame you. And I think those four state championship teams are glad that happened, too. But before that legendary career at Fresno City College, you had to break in through the high school ranks, and that included a stint roiling the rival Reedley Pirates as the head coach of the Sanger Apaches. One of those Apaches went on to make a pretty good name for himself in the professional ranks as a player and a coach. I'll ask Coach Slaughter about Tom Flores, and then we'll hear from the Raider legend about his high school mentor. The rest of Hometown Heroes right after this on KMJ.
A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the Valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis, its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and if you've been listening to KMJ for any length of time, you've probably heard me wax poetic about my hometown of Las Banas at one point or another. Every city has its secrets, and I'm going to fill you in on one my old neighbors have been keeping for 40 years. No matter where you live in the valley, you probably go through Las Banas every once in a while. So next time you're cruising down the 152, pull into Ming's Restaurant. The owner, Paul Cito, has been showing off his skills in the kitchen there since 1968. He has perfected the best Mongolian beef this side of the Great Wall. Delicate rice noodles underneath tender slices of beef with a flavor I can't even put into words. Whether you prefer mild, medium, or spicy, you'll be coming back for more. Ming's is closed on Mondays, so don't say I didn't warn you. But stop in any other day and try the pork wonton soup, Chinese chicken salad, or get everyone's attention with the sizzling chicken and vegetables. The possibilities are endless, but they all have one thing in common. Ming's time-tested commitment to taking your taste buds on a thrill ride. Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in Las Banas.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, a member of the Fresno Athletic Hall of Fame, the California Junior College Football Hall of Fame, of course, the Wall of Fame at Fresno City College, where he won four state championships. It's 91-year-old Claire Slaughter. We talked about Saipan and Okinawa, about coming home and marrying the younger sister of your college football teammate. You made it through the war. You're back home. So then you start coaching football. You coach some high school ball up in Galt, and then with the Sanger Apaches. You had a guy named Tom Flores play for you in Sanger. How good of a quarterback was he?
He wasn't too bad.
Yeah.
He was a quick learner, and he could do everything that you wanted a quarterback to do except run. He was not a runner. Mm-hmm. He was just a tall, skinny kid, but he could throw the ball, and he was smart. And he knew. I gave him some audibles that they could change to, and he just used those things like would hope he could, and he did. He was an excellent quarterback.
So I guess, and any coach who's ever coached anyone who moved on and did great things is probably always asked this, but when he played for you in high school, could you see in him the potential to do the things that he did in football?
Well, as far as his passing, yes. I'd say no to answer the question, because you just couldn't see him as the thing he'd last. Mm-hmm. That he'd get too easily injured, I would think. But he never got hurt.
And he turned into a pretty decent coach there with some Super Bowls to his credit. Did that give you pride to see him coaching a team in the NFL and winning the championship?
Oh, yeah. I was real, real happy for him. Great for him. He was very successful.
In 1955, in fact, I saw the article here on the archives of the Fresno City College newspaper. Let me see if I can pull that back up here. This is pretty good. Fresno Junior College's new head baseball coach and assistant football coach, Claire Slaughter, is a big man. Standing 6'2" and scaling 205 pounds, was born in Porterville, attended Porterville High School, played football, baseball, and basketball, and was an outstanding performer on the track team. After high school, he attended College of Pacific and again participated in the four sports. His coach was the immortal Amos Alonzo Stagg. Slaughter joined the Marine Reserves in April of 41, and after graduating from COP, served in Saipan, Okinawa, and Palawi as a captain in the 2nd Marine Division. He was discharged in November and 9 months later married Evelyn Crudelli in Stockton. And this is Slaughter's first year at FJC as head baseball coach and assistant football coach. And it's got your picture with that nice Marine Corps crew cut there. Right next to the ad for the 15-cent hamburger at McDonald's in 1955. What were you thinking when you came to this junior college to coach baseball and assist in football?
I was just real happy that I got the job that I did, because it was a good job, and I'm looking forward to it. And I got there quicker than most guys would have or did. I was very fortunate.
Was that because there was another Semper Fi guy that you went to work for? Did you and Hans Wiedenhofer have a special bond because you were both Marines?
Without knowing it, probably.
Yeah.
I never thought about it that way, but I'm sure that he probably had something to do with it, yeah.
And at that point, could you have envisioned coaching football there for 20 years, winning 4 state championships in a 6-year span? Had you kind of pictured that kind of success, or was that all a surprise to you?
Well, I can't say it was a surprise, but I certainly didn't expect it. I mean, I didn't even think about that. I don't think you thought about what you were going to do, except what you're going to do right then. Those things happen because of the success I had today.
Well, that's a good lesson for a lot of us today. So many times people get focused on what they might become. They forget about what they are right now. So from 59 to 79, you're the head coach at Fresno City College. And, of course, that legendary stretch, 68-69, you won the state championship, and then 72-73. So 4 out of 6 seasons, you had the state championship junior college football team. How did that happen? What was the secret to your success there?
Well, I like to think because I did a good job. But you're only as good as the players you've got. And I was fortunate enough to get players that I could, you know, bring the best of them out. And that's why I think we did it.
Do you think some of your Marine Corps discipline, if you will, toughness, bled over to what you expected out of your players and how you ran your team?
Oh, I'm sure it did. I mean, what I got out of the Marine Corps did a lot to me. It changed me in a lot of ways, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. And yes, to answer that question, very definitely.
I know this is a tough question, and I guess I need to ask it on two fronts. Let's talk football first. What are you most proud of in all the accomplishments in coaching, all the players who went on to, whether it was play professionally, win Super Bowls as coaches like Flores did, or even just be successful in business, in life? What gives you the most pride when you look back on your coaching career? What do you take the most pride in now?
All of those things. Actually, being a human, I'm proud of the success I had as a coach. And I'm also, and as a result of that, I'm proud of what so many of the players that played for me have done in their lives. So it's a combination.
Any special examples of that whenever you think about it, brings a smile to your face?
Well, like Tom Flores is a good example right off the bat. Very successful. The most successful in the coaching field, yeah.
And what about being a World War II veteran, specifically of the Marines? Once a Marine, always a Marine, they say, and I get the sense you believe that. when you think back on that time that you spent in the Pacific, all the guys who didn't come home and the brave men that you served with, what are you most proud of with that?
I don't know if being proud is the word, but coming home is the thing that was most important that I did. I've often said that if I had to go into the service, I'm glad I went to the Marines, because that's the best. I've always felt that. I'm just glad I came out of it, and glad I went. If I had to go in, I'm glad I went where I went.
And as a coach and being at Fresno City College for all those years, you're around so many young people, and obviously they're even younger now and even further removed from World War II. For those people who weren't alive then, what do you think is important for us to know about that time in our nation's history and what you and so many millions of Americans were able to do?
They don't really care because they don't really know. And there's no reason why they should know, except I think they should. But I don't think we emphasize in our other teachers now, I don't think emphasize those days enough. But time goes on, things go on. Things do not stay the way they are. And they're not gonna be the way that you want them to be. There's nothing you can do about it. So you just accept it and that's it.
Well, and I heard you say that they should know. So what should they know? What's the most important thing that they should know about the price that was paid for that freedom that they enjoy every day?
If people could know and appreciate what those of us have done who went through it, then they'd be happier where they are. And then they could see that they could be doing things too.
Next month is August, 66th anniversary. What's your secret? Did you just choose wisely? What's your secret to 66 years of marriage?
Putting up with it.
And vice versa?
Of course. Oh, yeah. I mean, if you made the right choice in the first place, and you've got to assume that you did, or you shouldn't have been married, you know, there's going to be ups and downs and differences of opinions at times. That's all part of life. But you don't go half-cocked and get mad, and you just accept things the way they are and live with it, and things are all right. She's a good wife.
When you think back now, and you think about what you told me, your first taste of combat as you're wading through knee-deep water toward the shores of Saipan, and a bullet hits the guy right next to you. It didn't hit you. You go on to survive the war. You end up as a Hall of Fame coach at Fresno City College, winning the only four state championships the school's ever had, impacting so many lives through the process. Now 66 years of marriage and still going strong. When you think about that bullet that took out the guy next to you and not you, how do you account for that you had the experience you did? Do you feel like somebody was looking out for you, or how do you make sense of that scenario?
That's quite a question. I firmly believe that God knows what he's doing. Things don't happen because they happen. I think they happen because God has planned it that way. So that's the way it's supposed to be. And not from anything I did, or not for anything I will do, but when the time comes for me to go, I'll go because God wants me to go. So that's the way I feel about it.
Well, and to follow up on that, and you're not the first veteran who's told me that God had a plan for him. In fact, I think most veterans I talk to say that. Some people hear you say God had a plan for you, and they think that's arrogant or presumptuous. But what I hear in you saying it is that that's a humbling concept for you, that God had things planned out for you. Am I getting that right?
Well, I don't think I'm bragging about something I did. No, that's just the way it is. I had done nothing to deserve it or to change it. That's just the way God plans it, and that's the way it's going to be.
I'm not about to disagree with you there. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us about it. Now, something we don't get to do too often, maybe we should do more often, hear from others about what makes a veteran special. I'll get to Tom Flores in a moment, but first, here is Doug Erickson, who has seen Coach Slaughter's passion not on the gridiron, but in helping men who are trying to get their lives back on track.
Coach came and volunteered at the Maroa Home, a residential discipleship program for addicted men in recovery. And he carries such a quiet strength. We know about his military exploits, and what I heard in the interview, I will simply say he's a very humble man and downplayed his service. Coach was a wonderful, wonderful soldier. But he brought that coach mentality, that Marine Corps mentality in. The men of the Maroa Home always looked up to him. He is, in the annals of Maroa Home lore, he is a hero. He counseled the men. He fathered the men. He inspected the rooms and gave them discipline when they weren't up to muster, using his terminology. And for me personally, he's been the epitome of faithfulness as a friend and a servant. He has served God alongside me at Maroa Home in such a way that's given me the courage to keep going in a lot of tough times. He's been a real encourager in my life. I just thank God that 20 years ago, he brought this older man into my life that would be today the same age as my own father, if my father were alive, also a vet. And I just thank God for Coach Claire Slaughter's influence in my life and in the lives of thousands of men at the Maroa Home over the last 20 years.
And then if we go back almost 60 years, there was a skinny quarterback at Sanger High School who went on to become one of just two men in pro football history, Mike Ditka's the other, to win championships as a player, assistant, and head coach. Tom Flores, who you're going to hear on the FMKMJ announcing the Raider games again this fall with Greg Papa. Tom, thanks for taking time for this.
I'm curious for you, being a little younger than that World War II generation, but living through World War II. What kind of respect do you have for those guys? And did you have an awareness even at that age of what was happening?
Well, you know, when you're young and you don't really realize it, it just something happens. My uncle was in World War II, and I had two uncles that were in World War II. You don't think about it much until years later when you start reading about it and recognizing, and you're old enough to maybe go to the service, you know, during Korean conflict and then obviously the Vietnamese thing. And then all of a sudden you realize how great these guys were and what the price they paid and what they did for our country. And it's just remarkable. And it seems to me it took forever to put up the World War II monument. They finally got it. I saw it in D.C. when I was there last year. It's a thrill to go by all the monuments and to see what veterans have done through the years, through the wars, through the hard times, just to keep our country free.
And back in the 1950s, when you were playing for this tall guy with a crew cut, did it occur to you that this guy coaching you guys had been storming beaches and bursting into caves and putting his life on the line to defeat Imperial Japan just a few years before that?
Well, we knew we were disciplined. We knew, and he was disciplined, and it didn't dawn on us that kind of a background that he had was carrying over into his coaching. And for a bunch of young kids, he set a precedent. And the precedent, when you look back, and you look where Sanger High School football is now, and you look where what he did then and what he started, he's probably the starter of the whole tradition that we had there in football for many, many years and continues to this day.
And you know that because you're not one of these guys who goes off somewhere else and never comes back home to the Valley. You've been back so many times and done so many great things for Sanger and for the whole Valley. And I'm hearing in what you say that you take pride in that tough-nosed mentality that the Apaches have and that maybe you feel like it started back with Coach Claire Slaughter.
Well, I'd like to think that, and when I think back, you know, prior to Coach Slaughter, you know, the team was okay. But when he arrived, and in a very short time, the team was not just okay. It was a championship team, a championship quality, and playing for championships. And you have to give him a lot of credit for starting that. And his legacy carried over into the years. Now, Chuck Shadan has carried on in between. There were a lot of other coaches and the winning tradition and the toughness. Because we were always underdogs, really, in a way, because we never had real big players. But we always managed to do pretty good.
Now, what happened if you got in trouble with Coach Slaughter? What would he do to you?
Well, I never got in trouble.
Never?
But he would give us a look. I mean, he had the look. And when we did our laps and we paid our penalties for goofing off, if we goofed off in practice or things of that nature. He worked us hard, but he was always fair. But, you know, you got to have a little fear involved. And when he gave you that look, scared the hell out of us.
Well, knowing, of course, what you went on to do and being the trailblazer that you were in the NFL and having the success you had with Mr. Davis and the Silver and Black, is that the kind of thing that you employed at some point, that ability to hold players accountable, to put a little fear of Coach Flores in them?
Well, yeah, and everybody does it their own style. You know, through the years, as you go through each phase of your career, if you're lucky enough like I was, where you played in high school and college, junior college, and then the pros, you have a variety of coaches, a variety of leaders, and I always made sure that I tried to take the things that I liked about every coach and use those things. And the things that I didn't like about them, don't use those things. And so every little bit here and there is what you develop into your own person. And then you do it with your own personality and your own style. So there was a little bit of Coach Slaughter, a little bit of Weidenhofer, a little bit of Moose Myers in at Pacific, and a whole lot of Al Davis.
Well, I'm sure that Coach is listening to this right now. Coach Slaughter, 91 years old and still with a handshake stronger than just about anybody. Is there anything you would want to say to him?
Well, I'd like to say thank you for the memories, and hope all is going well for you. And I hope I make it to 91 as well as you have.
And I think that is a perfect note to wrap up the show with today. Thanks to Tom Flores and Doug Erickson. Of course, to Claire and Ev Slaughter. If you see that terrific couple around, wish them a happy 66th anniversary. It's just weeks away now. I hope you'll join us again next Saturday for another installment of Hometown Heroes on KMJ.